Good evening, everybody. Welcome to a really, really special event. This is What's Your Map Live at Hay. I'm your host, I'm Jerry Broughton, and I'm really, really thrilled after coming here for 22 years to bring a new event to Hay. It's an award-winning podcast that comes to Hay for the very first time. It's in association with the Sunderland Collection. It's a bit different. I hope you're going to enjoy this. For those who haven't listened or subscribed already, you're forgiven, but let me just explain what we're going to do and the idea behind the podcast. The podcast is that I invite a guest, and tonight you've got three, but I invite one guest to talk about a map that's really special to them or that's inspired them in some ways. So sometimes they're experts who work closely with maps, map making, like geographers or artists. For others, their interest in maps is perhaps a little bit more surprising, but still, actually, I think, quite profound. What happens in the conversation is that each guest reveals the stories behind the maps, and in the process, I learn a bit about the guest, too. I like to talk about it as like desert island discs with maps, which is kind of what we're going to do. So we talk a bit about the maps, but then we break into a conversation about why they might be important to that person and a bit about their own history and lives. So in this really special event here at Hay, it's the first time, as I say, that we've done it, I've invited three wonderful guests from very different fields, from history, fiction, and journalism, to tell us about a map that's really important to them. And each has chosen a very different kind of map. I'm really fascinated by what we're going to be looking at. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give each guest just under 15 minutes to tell me what's their map, and then turn the discussion over to you. Perhaps you can share your favorite maps as well, because, you know, everybody loves maps, or everybody in this space loves maps, because you've just paid to come and listen to this, so you must love maps. So, so I'm going to start by introducing my guests in the order that they're going to speak as a JCB tractor comes by. Okay. From left to right, David Olushoga, OBE, is, I'm sure everybody agrees in this room, this country's most important public historian. He's a BAFTA-winning filmmaker, who many of you will know from his landmark TV series, including Civilizations, A House Through Time, and more recently, Empire. He's professor of public history at the University of Manchester, an author of prize-winning books, including... I've got to bring the books on stage. Black and British, a wonderful book. He even beat me in a prize to win this, and I was completely fine with that. It's fine. I have forgiven him. It's a wonderful book, Forgotten History. It's a great, great book, and he'll be signing afterwards. We'll all be signing afterwards. He's only allowed to answer questions about his recent appearance on Traitors once I am convinced he's acquitted himself sufficiently on maps. Okay? So
I'll be faithful to maps.
They've worked him to death this week, right? So yeah, give him a break. In the middle, the wonderful Emma Jane Unsworth, one of our best-known authors and screenwriters. Her hit novel, Animals, was adapted into a feature film for which she won a Best Independent Film Award, a BIFFA, for debut screenwriter. Her novel, Adults, was a Sunday Times bestseller, and she was nominated for a BAFTA. So she was nominated for BAFTA. David got one for the Amazon BBC series, The Outlaws. Her latest novel is the very funny and very heartbreaking, actually, book called Slags. The best description I came across about her novels is that they're like with nail for girls. So who knows what kind of maps we're going to get based on that. So this is that's amateur. And finally, but not least, Tim Marshall. Now, Tim doesn't have a BAFTA, but his book, Prisoners of Geography, has sold over 3 million copies, so I bet he doesn't care. I think it's absolutely fine. And as well as being best-selling author, look, they've given me mine. Mine's like, look at this. It's like, their book. There's Prisoners of Geography, which is Tim's book. Probably most people in this room probably actually have a copy. It's a great book. Tim's also written, as well as Prisoners of Geography, The Power of Geography and The Future of Geography. And I think it's fair to say Tim really likes geography. He's also a broadcaster and he's a leading authority on foreign affairs. As a former diplomatic editor of Sky News. We also share the misfortune of being Leeds United supporters, but that's not going to appear on any of the maps today, so don't worry about that. Please welcome our guests. Thank you. Thank you. It also strikes me that I have neither sold 3 million copies of a book, nor have I won a BAFTA, which is probably why I'm doing the interview. And the but what I do share in common with my lovely guests is that we are all from the North. This is a... Hey, audience, be nice. We're all coming from crippling poverty up there, you know. Come on, give us a break. We have David Griffin Gateshead, Emma Bury Manchester, and Tim Leeds. And I'm Leeds Bradford, I'm sort of a bit between. Now, I don't know what any of this means, but let's just get on and talk about the map. So, it's a wonderful thing to ask David. It's my favourite question. David Osterhage, what's your map?
Do we have a sting?
We have a sting. Here we go.
Right.
What is this map, David? Tell us.
So this is one of 9 plates from, I think, one of the most remarkable objects in the British Library. It is called the Queen Mary Atlas, something that we were talking about, Jerry and I were talking about for a BBC programme a while ago, because we are both fascinated by this map. This is the plate that is Northern Europe, but we should explain that it's one of 9. And it's a map from this moment, which is the 1550s, is as exciting because of the moment it comes from as it is in terms of what it shows. Because maps in the 1550s were about a world that was changing enormously rapidly. This is a moment when the New World has been discovered. We are 30 years after the conquest of the Aztec Empire. We are at a moment when maps are changing, they're moving, they're alive, because new things are being discovered, new conquests are being made, new people are being encountered. And there is an age of navigation, an age of exploration. And for us, I mean, the globe that we see at school, even though it is completely distorted, and falsely shows the gives us a very false impression of the actual land surface of the Earth, it is as it's always been. If you were somebody who was 50 in the 1550s, the map has completely changed. Mm. Most importantly, this shows Europe. Europe was always part of those earlier maps, but Europe is one of the 3 biblical continents. Asia, Africa, and Europe appear in the Bible. They appear in the ancient texts. The New World was literally that. It was new. But this map that shows Europe within the Queen Mary Atlas, it shows that maps are really about power.
Just orientate us a little bit, David. What are we looking at?
So at the bottom, we have Spain, and at the very bottom, we have the coast of North Africa. And once you see where you are, it looks very, very familiar. Spain, France, and then the British Isles and Ireland. What is fascinating about this map? There's 2 amazing stories about this map, but the first is about power. Then we'll talk about the damage done to this map, which is the really astonishing story. But this is about a projection of a world in which Spain is everything.
Hence why Spain is here. I mean, you don't usually see a map like this. So you see Spain very, very predominantly sort of at the bottom half of the map, connected, interestingly, as you're going to tell us, about England.
Yeah, and Spain, as you will notice, is actually not that big relative to France in the real world. Spain seems to have expanded enormously, and France seems to have contracted enormously. Spain is the center of the world because this map was about that moment when Spain's empire, not just in the New World, but in Europe, was expanding, and it was consuming some unusual and unexpected nations.
And it's about a marriage. Tell us about this. It's about this amazing marriage between Mary Tudor and Philip, King of Spain. So this moment where England could become effectively Spanish.
So the map was produced by a Portuguese cartographer called Diogo Homem. And in 1525, he had murdered somebody in Portugal and thought it was a good time, therefore, to leave Portugal. And he found himself in England. He had these incredible skills. The Portuguese were great cartographers, and he was able to apply those skills, offer those skills to anyone who had the money. And of course, the people who have the money are the aristocracy. So in 1554 or 5, he was commissioned to produce an atlas, a series of maps, by Queen Mary, hence the Queen Mary Atlas. This is Queen Mary, Mary Tudor, also known as Bloody Mary. It wasn't for her, however. She was paying for it. She was the one who commissioned it. It was intended as a gift to her husband, who was King Philip II of Spain. That's the reason why Spain is outsized in this map. That's the reason why France has kind of shrunk down to a fraction of its actual size. And that's why all the flags and the coats of arms of Spain are visible. We can see Granada, we can see Aragon, we can see Asturias in the north. That Spain is far more detailed and far more described visually than the other nations. However, commissioned maybe 1554, 1555, it was delivered in 1558, and something else that happened in 1558 was that Queen Mary died. So it was inherited by her successor, and her successor, of course, was her half-sister, Elizabeth. That was the end of Mary's kind of counter-reformation, a return to the Reformation under Elizabeth. But it was also, of course, the end of this union of marriage between Mary and Philip. Now, I think one of the things we all know about Elizabeth's relationship with Spain is that it wasn't that good. There's this thing called the Armada, which leads us to the kind of most remarkable story about this map. Because if you look at the British Isles, you can see Scotland in the north, you can see Ireland in the west, you can see Ireland's got the symbol of the harp. On England, what you can see is a coat of arms, but it's actually split in half. Half of it is the coat of arms of England. The other half is defaced. It's been scratched out. That was the coat of arms of Spain, because this was a gift to King Philip of Spain from his English wife, and it was to represent their union in marriage, the union between England and Spain, which was in effect Spain becoming the kind of England becoming the imperial possession of Spain. For this moment, this crossroads in history, the English could have been almost colonial subjects or sort of subjects through royal union of the Spanish. Elizabeth obviously is not married to Philip. Elizabeth ends up fighting the Armada, and this goes into the private library of Elizabeth. And so that raises the question, who defaced the map?
Who defaced the map, I wonder?
Yeah. Now, we don't know. But some historians believe, and I really, really want to believe, that it was Elizabeth. Because it is such a contrast to those images that we have of the Virgin Queen, of Gloriana, of this incredible, magical figure, being the most human thing you can possibly be, petty. Yeah. So in my dreams, and in the dreams of other historians who love this map, this is the moment when Elizabeth let herself down.
Sorry, I'm going to be really trite, but do you think maybe Mary gave it to Philip and he went, oh, I really wanted a microwave and I've got a map. And he went, this is rubbish. But it is, that's a sort of silly comment, but the fact is that the power of this map, this is not a map that you would use to get from one place to the other. No. Emma's going to show us a map which is precisely hardwired about how you get around different places. This has got nothing to do with navigation and discovery at all. Yeah. I mean, it's as you said, this point about power. This is a map which is representative of power, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the reason you said Spain is the size it is, that Spain's cities and Spain's coats of arms are there on the map, is because this is about showing that this is a world dominated by Spain. The other plates on this map show the New World, and they go back in time 30 years. The map of South America shows Cortes and his armies arriving in South America. It is geography, but it's also a work of history. It is describing the story of how Spain has built this astonishing, unprecedented empire in South America, and you see the Spanish coat of arms all over the world, stamped on these possessions. It is about claiming the world. And that is why that map, that coat of arms split between the two nations, the husband and wife, Mary and Philip, is looming, dominating England. But it is not the only Spanish claim stamp on the map. But it's also, it is a work of art.
This is what's so beautiful about it. I mean, we've looked at it together in the BL, and you open page after page. Of course, it's in an age of print, but the thing is that if you want a really posh map, you don't get a printed one. You get the artist to make the map for you. It has to be hand-drawn. And this is an utterly, utterly beautiful thing when we flick through it.
The colours are like Titian. They burst off the page. As Jerry was saying, we kind of stood there in awe of the real thing in the British Library recently, and it is incredibly beautiful. But it is also that moment in the middle of the 16th century We're in the age of exploration, as it's sometimes called, the age of discovery, as other people call it. But we're also in a kind of pre-modern world. Mm. There are sea monsters, and there are sea monsters existing alongside whales and dolphins. So there's the real and the verifiable, what is coming back into Europe from the encounters of sailors. But there's also, always on the edge of what is known, there is the mystical, there is the fantastical, there are sea monsters. It's also an age in which the ship, and you can see in the sort of bottom left-hand corner there, there is a sailing ship. I think there were 22 ships depicted on the nine plates, because these are the most incredible pieces of technology on Earth in the 16th century. The carrack, the Spanish and Portuguese vessels that are plying the oceans, these huge ocean-going, heavily armed cargo ships, they are like the space shuttle. And they have just discovered the new world, which may as well have been a new planet. I mean, what I love reading about this period, I mean, just 30 years before this map was created, Albrecht Dürer had gone to an exhibition in Brussels, which is again dominated by Spain, where objects, gold work and feather work and other works of art from the Aztec kingdom that had been sent back literally by Cortes. Mm. And Dürer, who, if anybody in that moment in history was appreciative of art and design and form and who would be motivated to feel it deeply, he writes in his diary this kind of feeling of joy at the ingeniousness, he says, of people from foreign lands. So the excitement of this age does come across. This has been produced for power. It's about a royal union of powerful people. But that excitement about the world, that it is changing, it is fluid, new places are emerging, new lands may well be discovered. They haven't yet discovered Australia. Yeah. If the new world of South America and North America was new, what else might be new? And it is geography and history and fantasy and imagination and art all rolled into one. It is beautiful.
Just one final question about sort of what it tells us, I guess, about Tudor England and its place in that wider world. You've kind of been indicating it, but the way in which it's kind of on the periphery at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're in 1558. So, of course, by 1603, we've got the East India Company, we've got the development of colonies in Virginia. Just sketch out that sense of what's happening. How is that changing so quickly, David? I mean, you've worked on this around the empire work, but just give us a sense of where we go almost from here.
Well, I think one of the problems we have with English history in the 16th century is that it is populated with the most astonishing monarchs. So we have Henry VIII and we have Elizabeth. And so because they are the most incredible figures in our history, it is very easiest for us to imagine that their status reflects on the status of England. And I'm afraid it doesn't. We are the also-runs of Europe. We're relatively small, relatively powerless. A wealthy country, but nowhere near the power of Spain. So England is literally on the periphery, but it is also now religiously on the periphery. It is a pariah state under Elizabeth that's been excommunicated. Our queen has been excommunicated by the Pope. But it is also a moment when the English have seen what Spain and Portugal have got. Mm. This map absolutely shows to Elizabeth that England is not just on the periphery of Europe geographically, it is on the periphery of this new world which is based on the trade, the transportation across oceans of these incredibly exotic, exciting objects and spices and trades. So it is that moment when the English are beginning to realize they need to get into this game, that being peripheral is not an option. You have to set up trading companies, as we see later in the reign of Elizabeth. You have to establish colonies, as we see in the 17th century in the Caribbean and in North America. That these are the last decades, really, when England is just England.
Yeah. And saying that, it's interesting because you see Ireland, and then at the very top of the map, you have Scotland. Have we got any Scots in here? No? What? Yeah. I mean, what do you think? I mean, it's not so great, is it? It's not a great depiction. Well, it's not a great depiction. So that's why we're going to move on and we're going to turn to Emma, because Emma's going to talk about a more updated version of what that map of Scotland looks like in 1558 based on the books that she's been writing recently. So Emma, what's your map?
I've got something for the Scots, let me tell you. Okay. So this is not a work of art. I just want to start by saying that.
But it's a proper map.
But to me, it is, in a way. I think, and it means, this map means so much to me. And it's also a map that has revealed, I guess, layers of meaning to me. The more that I have worked with it and used it, it's a map that I use. I guess firstly I should say I really love maps. I'm a person who really, so I was delighted when I was asked to do this. I'm one of those people who on a long haul flight will watch the map, like watch the plane inch across the map while everyone else is watching movies. I'll watch the map because I find them very soothing. And I love the tube map as well. Like one of my favourite things about London is the tube map. I think probably because we live in an increasingly chaotic world, I think maps are just very soothing kind of signifiers of order quite often, and there's just something very calming about them for me anyway. And so yes, this map is a map that I use, that I have used many, many times, and that has, it's meant many things to me over the years, to do with my work and to do with my sense of personal history, I guess, with my family. And also just in terms of my own kind of well-being and freedom, and just what I've used it for, which was primarily for a motorhome trip. And many of you may recognise this route. It's kind of, it's a bit, what I want to talk about is a bit of an amalgamation of the North Coast 500 and the West Coast 200 maps. Any fans in here? Anyone know what I'm talking about?
There's a bit of a pointer. It's a bit rubbish.
Yeah, okay. So those are like two like really great routes in Scotland. Anyone done them? Has anyone done those in a motorhome? Maybe
you've heard of them? Yeah, we have.
Yes.
I think that it's like one of the most beautiful trips you can do in the whole world.
Not in weather like
this. Not in weather like this. That's true. And not like after makers of the midges. but if you do it, if you choose your month correctly, then it's honestly like this... The sort of touring Scotland in a motorhome is I think one of the most glorious and gorgeous like trips that you can do, because there's so many beautiful things along the way. The A82, which is the sort of stretch of road between sort of top of Glasgow and then all the way towards over to the west coast, I think is the most beautiful road in the world. It goes through Glencoe, which is like the mountains, and so that for me is just like if you want a good road recommendation of a good road, then the A82 has got it. I'm such a nerd when I say that, but it really is, it's just like, it's one of the most beautiful roads, and the first time I drove along it, I couldn't believe how gorgeous it was. I was just like blown away, because I guess I'd not been to mountains beyond Cumbria is beautiful, but Scotland is kind of like that on steroids, and it's just like next level sort of mountains, and yet the first time I used this map was about 20 years ago. And I just decided to give myself a solo motorhome trip because I thought I might enjoy it. I thought I might like the solitude. Everyone thought I was mad, kind of going on my own in a motorhome for a month. I've since had an autism diagnosis, and I wonder if that has anything to do with it. Maybe not. Maybe it's just who I am. But I just really liked the idea of that extreme solitude as a bit of an antidote to the stresses of modern life at that point in time, I guess. But I just really thought I can get in a motorhome. Home. I love driving. There's something very soothing about driving, I think, as well. Something about the world unspooling in your peripheral vision. I think, for me, a long solo drive is as good for my well-being as a yoga session or a massage. I just think there's something about driving on my own that I just really love.
But did you take a map with you? Did you use a sat nav, or did you do?
I used a sat nav, but no, this
you're
was
allowed.
20 years
That's
ago.
Fine.
So, but I think I probably had both. I did have both because I do love a physical map as well. So I think I would have had both with me. And also, your phone doesn't work. There's no reception in a lot of these places up in the mountains, which is great and one of the reasons why I went. So I did have a physical map because you needed that just as a kind of backup, and because I was kind of scared going on my own on that kind of journey, because I think the road and a solo road trip. In literature and probably in a lot of culture, it symbolises different things for men and women. And I think for men, it quite often symbolises, the road symbolises the beginning of a journey. And we have all these great stories like Jack Kerouac and you know, the stories of men soloing. But for women, a solo road trip quite often means the end of your journey. It means, you know, there's awful things that happen to you. And we're fed these stories about, you know, that are meant to make us feel fearful about doing it. So I was full of trepidation as well about doing this trip, even though I had a strong urge to go and do it on my own. But I did it, and it was great, and it was, you know, it was. There were times when I thought I've really messed up here, going on my own to a place without reception. I nearly lost two toes, or I like to think I nearly lost two toes because it sounds more dramatic. I think it was actually frost nip that I had. I basically drank too much whiskey one night and slept with my foot out of my sleeping bag, and there was no heating because I was like wild camping, so I didn't have electric hookup, and I didn't have any heating on in the van, and my foot was like properly blue and frozen when I woke up the next day. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to lose a toe. And like, what do you do? Do you have to make the decision to either drive to the nearest hospital, which is a long way away, or just rub like hell.
Rub it.
And hope for the best. I rubbed like hell and it was fine. It was all good. So I told myself I nearly lost two toes. My partner, who's a doctor, says, no, it was more like frost nip. It wasn't frostbite. But I like to think, for dramatic purposes, that it was more dramatic than that. And then another time, the van got stuck on ice, which was very exciting. So I had to kind of get the mats. I tried to dig it out at first with a dessert spoon, tried to dig the wheels out of the ice, you know.
Sorry, a dessert spoon.
It was all I had. I didn't have a shovel.
I've read this piece. Did you think that might work?
I did. That's all I could think of to dig with. Ridiculous. But what worked in the end, top tip, was the mats. You know, the mats that you get in the footwell? Stick them under your wheels. You're away. Bit of traction.
And the dessert spoon.
And the dessert. I'm sure the dessert spoon helped.
Sell this camper van to an SNP politician, did you?
No, but I should have. No, I've only ever rented camper vans. So I've had many great experiences on this road, many exciting experiences on this road, and on this kind of trip and in this part of the world. And so I guess that's the 2D layer of my relationship with this map. At face value, it's a great route to do, and I've had many great experiences doing it. The second sort of way I want to talk about it is that I used the same journey, which is kind of like a route from Glasgow all the way to the coast and looping back around again. I used that journey to plot a novel. So my latest novel, which is called Slags, is that there's one timeline. There are two timelines. Half of it's set in the 90s, which is partly why it's called Slags, because it's about things, that, the words that get shouted at women, or did in the 90s. And then the second, the other timeline is it's two sisters in the present day who go on a motorhome trip. And I wanted to put them in a very difficult, intimate situation, because they're two sisters who have got a lot of things to talk about and a lot of things to process from their past, from their teenage years in the 90s, which is why the 90s timeline makes sense. And so I wanted to put them in a situation that was tricky, where I could explore certain things, and I couldn't find that present day timeline for ages. Excuse me, I couldn't work out how to do it, how to plot it. I knew I wanted them to have some kind of road trip, because I love, in my mind, I wanted to do something that was somewhere between Thelma and Louise and Sideways, because I love both of those films. And so I thought, where am I going to do it? And then I suddenly realized, like, this is the route that I need to use for that road trip, because I know it so well, and I love it so much. And I can then use the places on that map.
And you and I talked about this, didn't we, about this great thing that, so I don't know if you know this, but the archaic word for a map is a plot. So a plot is a map. And we were talking before about how so many writers then create a plot, and a plot is a bit like a map, because actually it's quite spatial. So you create a sense of movement, and many great writers do that. They kind of work out the geography, as it were, of their plot. And a lot of the fancy writers, you know, Tolkien sort of did these amazing maps. So a plot is a map, and a map is a plot, which I love that.
I love that too. Yeah. And I think you put a narrative on top of a map every time you use it. I think every time you use a map, it's imbued with a new bit of meaning, I guess, from a memory that you've made along the way. So every time I've looked at this map and used this map, it's had another layer kind of put on top of it. But specifically to use it for the structure of the novel, the way I plot a novel is I draw, it's not very sophisticated because I don't like thrillers, but I usually draw an arc, and then I put two crosses on it. And one cross represents the inciting incident, and the second cross represents the crisis moment, kind of end of Act Two. And then that's what I work off. And so for this, using that map to do this, I had the sisters kind of kicking things off. And then when they get to Glen Nevis, which is one of my favourite campsites in the world, at the foot of Ben Nevis, that's where the inciting incident takes place. And then they get all the way, they actually get to Loch Ness, my version of a sea monster, where the big monstrous thing from the past, I guess, sort of metaphorically and using that great location as part of Scotland, that's where that happens too. So I used it to kind of map that, map out my story. And I think that was, you know, it, and I knew it so well, loved it so well, but I just felt as though these two women who were going into the wilderness as well, and so it all kind of fitted with what I'd used this map for in my own life, as to what I wanted my characters to do. I wanted them to shed everything that they'd learned in the past 20 years when they hadn't really spoken to each other since they were teenagers, and they needed to go to the wilderness where the social norms weren't the same and be completely alone, and then they were going to talk and work some stuff out that they'd been through, and things would be revealed and monsters would rear up and they're going to have to kind of deal with them.
So does the map now take on a different meaning for you, having written through those stories? Do you look at the map and see it in different ways?
Definitely, because the other thing that happened, which is my third layer of meaning to kind of put on the top of this map, is that as I was doing, I think, the kind of second or third draft of the novel, I looked a little bit more into the areas that the clans in Scotland were in on this part of Scotland. And what I found was, I write semi-autobiographical fiction, I suppose, and so I always use a little bit of myself in what I write. And something that I discovered was that my kind of family history is very much deeply connected to the part of Scotland that I'd been the most drawn to, which was the far northwestern coast. My mum's maiden name was Mackie, so my granddad was Mackie, and that was a Mackay. It was like an anglicisation of Mackay, and the Mackay clan was, if you look at a map of clans, which I think they're going to put on the website. But if you look at the clan map of Scotland, the Mackays were very much located in the far northwest, which was always the part I'd been pulled to, and that just blew my mind, because I thought, how did I know that? On some level, I feel like on some molecular level, I was kind of drawn there, and felt creatively pulled there and inspired by there, and so that was another great kind of connection to this journey.
We're going to move on, because what's interesting, and we didn't really know how we'd done this, that I guess with David talking about a map of the past, Emma talking about a map of the present, and Tim, you're going to take us really into the future. So take us into space and tell me, Tim, what's your map?
Well, it's more prosaic.
Oi, that's not a map. Oi.
Oh, yes, it is.
I'll let you have it.
Yes, it is. I was struck in both the previous conversations that this is both linear and circular, especially because you both brought up monsters, you know, there be dragons, as they used to say on the old maps. As I don't know if you've seen Alien, the film. Yeah. I mean, it's probably a much nicer version, but, you know, they're out there. And we can't map it yet, but we're trying. I went down to the caves at Lascaux in France a couple of years ago, and they've got the Hall of the Bulls, the cave drawings. And there's a strong body of evidence that people reckon, and you can do the painting, and then you can superimpose some of our star systems onto their horns. And there's a strong body that they were actually looking up there 40,000 years ago and drawing maps. Yeah. You know, this goes back a long way. So I'll fast forward all the way up to now. And the reason I chose this map, although it's not my favorite map, I mean, how could it be? But I just thought it's a really useful map to show how there's a geography to space, because I don't think people don't really think of it in those terms. And there's what's called astropolitics, which is geopolitics but taking place up there, or international relations taking up place there with a geographical element in it. So, for a kickoff, if you're going to launch a rocket to get to space, you better launch it west to east, because you'll get more of a slingshot because of the rotation of the Earth. So immediately there's a bit of geography there, which is why the Americans go from Cape Canaveral, it's closest to the equator for them. The Russians used to go from Kazakhstan, and we have a Cornwall.
Have we sent much up from Cornwall?
We do, actually, but it's not a fair comparison or joke, because I was talking about vertical liftoff. We put ours underneath planes and then slingshot them up. It doesn't count. So you better launch in that direction, and you better launch as close to the equator as possible. And then you get up to low Earth orbit. And this is a key piece of real estate, a key piece of geography. This is where most of the 14,000 satellites are, running around and round and round. And although it's a massive, massive space area, it is getting filled up. It's thought by 2030 there'll be at least 30,000 satellites, and some predictions have it as much as 60,000 satellites. And we don't have the laws about how close they can come to each other, whether my satellite can creep up behind yours. We've already got dual technology stuff where to get rid of defunct satellites, the satellite can come up with a massive claw, grab hold of it and sling it up into the satellite's graveyard. But what happens if my satellite's got my nuclear early warning codes in it? Why are you creeping up behind me with your satellite? So, you know, all this stuff is coming into play, and there's a geographic element of it. You also you need to know where the radiation belt is. You know, and this is geography. And if you move up to the bit between low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit, that is an unimaginable area. I mean, I know infinity is a little hard to get your head around, but I can't even imagine when you look into the figures. The Americans had a robotic space plane that was flying around in that lighter gray area for 2 years and nobody spotted it. Because it's something like 3,000 times bigger than the surface of the Earth. And if you want to hide an aircraft on Earth, you can do it. Mm. 3,000 times? Yeah. And nobody knew it was up there until it came back in. And I mean, it was probably a spy plane, but we don't know what it was doing to this day. And then if you go up to geosynchronous orbit, this is an orbit that if you hang on a satellite or a machine, the orbit turns at the same speed as the Earth is turning. So the machine you have will always be above the same piece of Earth, which of course is extremely useful for a whole bunch of things, especially James Bond or whatever. Mm. And they can read, you know, what brand of sunglasses you're wearing. But the bandwidth required to get your signal down, because it's so high up, is so wide, you can't park all your satellites right next to each other the way you can in low Earth orbit. And therefore, it's first come first served, which means for the developing world, you ain't going to get a slot there, which is hardly fair, but there we are. There are about 80 countries now active in space. Musk has slightly democratized the entry to space because the costs have come down. Yeah. Something like you can put a box satellite up for like $3,000 now. Then we move to where the real action might be, and that's the moon. And there's a real geography to the moon. There's something called a Lagrange point near it, L1 and L2. Lagrange points are where you can also put a machine and it will stay relative to the thing that it's orbiting. It'll stay in the same position to that, which again is pretty useful for the James Webb telescope, for example. Mm. Daft if it just sort of drifted off and started taking random photographs. In the future, L5, I think it is, which is very, very far away, that's where the first space city will be built in 400 to 500 years. And again, very useful that it's a Lagrange point, because if you built your city, you're living there, you go back to Earth for a holiday, you come back and it's not there anymore. But it will be if it's as long as it's at L5. So there's this geography, but the most important bit is probably the moon. Now, the Americans did Artemis 2 this year, which has really generated a lot of interest, but I believe when Artemis 3 goes, and they're actually going to walk on the moon again. Now, some of you are even as old as I am, and I remember I was 10 in 1969. I remember watching it live, and it was mind-blowing. And I think that's going to happen to another generation of the under 40s who never saw that. I think it's going to generate that level of excitement and say something about the 21st century. And we will learn a lot about the geography of the moon. Now, I don't want to diss the Americans too much, but any fool can land on the Sea of Tranquility, okay? Perhaps not. Perhaps it's rocket science. But think about the sea. If tonight, and it's nearly a full moon, if you look up, bear with me, if that's the moon. Actually, no, if that's the moon, that's the Earth. Imagine that's the Earth is the moon. If you look in the middle of the Earth, just look a little bit to the right, when you're looking at the moon tonight, you'll see a shaded area. Just underneath it, where it's not shaded, that's the Sea of Tranquility. That's how you can spot it. So in the middle, just a little bit across, and it's completely flat land. That's what I mean about, you know, any fool can land there. And you get 2 weeks of sunlight and 2 weeks of night. 2 weeks of sunlight, 2 weeks of night, which is not very good for your solar panel charging. But at the lunar South Pole, the Indians have found water ice in the Shackleton Crater, named after
it's
a great
Shackleton Crater. Yeah. Brilliant.
Named after a great explorer, Shackleton. And in the Shackleton Crater, there are mountains. They're called the Peaks of Eternal Light. And they get sunlight pretty much 365 days a year, and there's no atmosphere. It's really great 24/7 sunlight. You can make energy out of it. You can make energy out of the water when you get... That's why everyone's going back to the moon and everyone's going to the lunar South Pole. And there's a race on between the Americans and the Chinese. Who's going to get there first and who's going to build the first base? And the Americans were saying 2032. They got someone from HS2 in and it looks like it'll be 22nd century or something. But now I heard, and just recently I was at a space conference and someone said to me, we believe the Chinese are going to try and beat us there, which is why it wasn't a surprise to me when I read the news yesterday that the Americans are going to try and build it by 2030, which is pretty exciting. Yeah. So I just predict in a couple of years' time, maybe even next year, we will see this, hopefully not too much of an explosion, but an explosion of interest in this new frontier where there are monsters and there are dragons and we will map it. And the reason I know it's going to happen is the same reason that you fell in love with that map, the same reason that it's in us to explore. It is deeply, deeply human. What is at the top of that mountain? What is across that body of water? And what is across that great expanse? And that's why it doesn't matter about if you can argue about budgets, but we will go.
It does strike me as very interesting that it's really telling a similar story to what David's saying in 1558. And so then I wonder, you know, there's both the wonder of that exploration. We saw that with the Artemis II images. Yeah. We all just were beguiled by those images, but it comes with deep colonial consequences and a kind of claim for empire.
Yeah, briefly on that, I mean, David talked about going off and get colonies. What is also up in the Shackleton Crater, which is hundreds of miles across, is lithium, titanium. All the stuff that we need, cobalt, all the stuff we need for the 21st century technology and for your super semiconductors, finite amount here, obviously a finite amount there, but that's why they're going as well. And for the leapfrogging up to Mars. Mm. But it's if you've got water and sunlight, you may be able to live there. And if you can do that, you may be able to mine there. Mm. And so it is a new colony. And lastly on the colonies, most of you probably read the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea most evenings.
Yes.
Copy by your bedside table. Yeah, of course you do. And therefore, you'll know it has all these laws. Well, only a few countries signed it to begin with, but then it grew and grew and grew, and about 130 countries now sign up to UNCLOS out of 193. And it's become the rules of the road for the sea. The Americans have got the Artemis Accords. And it's a bilateral between them and whoever signs it. It started out with 12 countries. They've grown to about 40 countries, and it's probably going to rule the rules for the 21st century in space travel, the rules of the road. Article 7, if you've put all that money into going up there, landing, building your base, and starting to dig, you can declare a security zone.
Right.
That sounds a bit like sovereignty to me.
Yeah.
For how long? Unspecified. So it will happen again. Now, this time, thank goodness, the word colony will not perhaps have quite the negative, except for the clangers. Thank you.
You're such a pro, because I said, you know, we'd sort of wrap up about 15 minutes to so we could invite you in to have conversations, and you did it, nailed it. Although just before we do, I'm just interested if you want to talk across the maps or anybody who's really struck. I mean, we've talked a little bit about, oh yeah, we have all three up, that's lovely. If anybody had any thoughts about crossing over each other's maps or things that they were
thinking. I want to know, well, I'm struck by Hibs and Hearts in Edinburgh and the word Hibernia. Up there, which I guess a lot of people don't know where the Hibs and Hibernian for the football fans amongst us. I want to know why Ireland's so big. Mm. It's not that big, is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
It's what?
It's not that big, really. I mean, look, the Mercator projection has Greenland being about the same size of Africa. Africa is 12 times the size of Greenland.
That's why Trump wanted it, right? He just saw it was really big. I won that bit. Yeah. And then somebody said, dude, it's the Mercator
projection. But Ireland is not that big relative to...
No. A lot about it is wrong.
Yeah.
But what is amazing is that at least this is known. What's fascinating on the other plates when it gets to America is it just fades away.
Yeah.
Because the ships haven't got there.
Yeah.
And the world... Yeah. Just
You can see the end of the pencil line,
yeah.
Because that's the end of knowledge.
Yeah.
I love that.
The
story about distant geography I always love is that the last real place in Gulliver's travels is Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, because that's as far as people had got. And after that, it's Lilliput. And when people were transported to Tasmania, they weren't sent to this prisoner colony. The phrase that judges would say in court is transported beyond the seas, yeah, to the place of, you know, beyond imagining.
Greeks 2,000 years ago had a map. Terra Incognita was the name of this mass of earth they said must be at the bottom,
yeah,
because they knew the earth
was balance.
Exactly, because if he didn't have it, the earth would topple over.
Yeah, yeah. So they prove the existence of a great southern continent,
yes,
which comes out to be Australia.
Pretty amazing.
But for nonsense reasons. Yeah, yeah. But and that phrase actually appears on the other plates.
Terra
still being used in the 16th century.
And one thing about that size as well, I think, of Scotland is we forget that in that Tudor period, you know, Scotland is a place of trouble and rebellion. You know, we know all the great Northern Earls, you know, under Elizabeth were Catholic. So anywhere sort of north of Stoke was a bit of a problem, really, for the Tudors.
And in 1707,
because they were Welsh,
we closed the back door.
Yeah.
Now, that 1707 was all about closing the back door so the French couldn't come across and then down. We closed that back door.
Yeah.
I think what strikes me about all of them as well is that when you're creating a map, it's a choice, isn't it? Which points. It's nothing to do with size. It's nothing to do with kind of what's the most important in some ways, but rather than it's a narrative that you're imposing on a space. Yeah. And you're saying these are the points that are meaningful because of the narrative you want to impose on that and present kind of like this version of a reality. Yeah.
Which is why Lewis Carroll says, you know, in Sylvie and Bruni Concluded, you'll remember this, that they say, well, we made a map and it was perfect because it was the same size as the kingdom. But then we realised that it blotted the land out and it was very bad for the crop, so we had to get rid of it. And Borges tells a similar story. So, as Emma's saying, you have to make a decision about what you leave out and what you put in a map. You can't, because you can't square the circle. We're looking at a sort of image of the globe. You can't square and flatten a globe. So you just have to make those decisions. And I think really all three of the guests have been showing us about the kind of decisions that you make. So we're going to not applaud them yet because I do want to open it up. We have 11 minutes left and I'm sure that everybody has many questions to ask. If we bring the lights up, we have roving mics. So questions generally for any of three guests. Oh, a question there. Lady there, yeah.
Thank you. My question was actually just on this point about choices. Is there anything that you think the map makers have missed out in your maps that you would want to put back in?
Good question.
Well, yes.
Yes. Experts lod so.
It's less visible from the map of Europe, but 16th century maps, the world inside the continents is very often empty.
Yeah.
It is a world in which the information has come from mariners. What they care about is coastlines, rocks, and ports, the places that are critical to their journeys. Mm. And so coastal towns and coastal settlements are all described, they're all named. The interiors tend to be blank spaces. And this was true right up until the 19th century. There is a line in Heart of Darkness where Conrad's character, Marlowe, is describing being a young boy and working in a shipping office and seeing these maps of Africa with the great white spaces in the center of the continent and being kind of drawn there and feeling this irresistible impulse to fill in those white spaces. So you can see that in 16th century maps, and it is going to take centuries. It's going to mainly be epidemiological sciences, medical sciences, prophylactics for yellow fever and malaria, more than anything else, that is finally going to allow for those last parts of the earth to be filled in detail.
And it's also that shift between artistic and scientific traditions. So, as David was saying, those African maps, Jonathan Swift has this great line, he says, with the maps of Africa, he said, they put elephants for want of towns. So you just put an elephant in the middle. This is fine. And then the only process, the scientific form of mapping, which is really from the Ordnance Survey in the 19th century, is inherently political and colonial. I mean, so the map even that Emma was showing, I mean, what I find very profound about that is it comes out of mapping techniques, which are Ordnance Survey mapping techniques, which is a response to the Jacobite Rebellion, right? Which is when the Brits and the English get, you know...
So they know how far to put the fortresses.
Absolutely.
I don't need to tell people of Wales about the English coming and building fortresses, but it was done later in Scotland also.
You can see the Hereford map on Monday. Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. Were any others? We've got mics around. Oh, so, yeah. Thank you, sir.
We've had some of your favourite maps. What are some of your least favourite maps?
The Mercator.
Just explain why.
I think a map that, as we've been hearing, distorts the relative size of the world, distorts the relative importance of the nations of the world and the people who populate them. I remember driving years ago from Cape Town all the way, I was writing a book about Namibia, and in the end, right all the way up to the Angolan border. And if I had not been brought up on that dishonest map, I wouldn't have dreamed of attempting that journey. It was an amazing experience. But within 2 days, you're going, Africa is far, far bigger than I could possibly have imagined because of this distorted, dishonest map. And we have better alternatives. The Peter's connection is more honest.
The Peter's map, for example. I've got an additional problem with it. It reflects the time in which it was written. I mean, I don't think it's dishonest in a sort of really nasty way. It just reflects the time when Mercator drew it up. Europe is in the center. Britain's in the center of that. Its capital city, Leeds, is in the center of that there. And it just reflects, but I actually now nearly always use a different version of a Mercator projection, which puts the Asia Pacific in the center of the world. Because politically, economically, trade-wise, that is the new center of the world.
And most people are Asian.
Yes, and you can put 3/5 of the world's population in a small square in the middle of that map. So I just think that conceptually, as a picture, most of the world maps that we classically use in the classrooms, on the wall, or whatever, should actually put the Asia Pacific in the middle, just to get our heads around the fact that the world has moved on. It's not to say that Europe is done. It's not to say that Europe's not important. It is. But it would be more honest. Yeah.
Just to say, this is a map. It's a 1569 map made by a Flemish mapmaker called Gerard Mercator. And he tries to sort of square the circle. So he says explicitly, he says, what you need to do is you need to distort the world north and south. So if you look it up, you can look it up now. He shows the world with the poles distorted to infinity. Right? So across the equator, it's quite sort of equable. But David and I would say, yes, and that's also an imperial moment because you want to navigate east to west. They don't want to navigate north to south, so they can create massive distortion at the poles. But in the 16th century, as David was showing us on that map, you need to go east to west, and that has its own sort of colonial imperial dimensions. But for centuries and throughout the 19th century, up till in the 20th century, you will have probably grown up, those people in the room who are over 50 will have had atlases, which were Mercator atlases. And I'll come somewhere down between the two views, you know, it is inaccurate. It is very inaccurate, and it has serious sort of colonial...
But they all are.
They all are. That's what you're saying. They all are. It's what kind of map do you want? Yeah. That was Emma's point. You know, everybody, you need to know choices about maps you want. And my concern is, you know, what standard maps are we using now anyway? So online, we've sleptwalked into a situation where we don't have any standardized maps anyway, because all the multinational corporations are now doing it. Where do you all go for your maps? You all go online, right?
You can have fun with maps, though. Yeah. You can do maps which have got everything the other way up, not upside down.
Yeah.
And it just messes with your head. It's really worth it.
If you see the Mediterranean laid from north to south,
fantastic.
It is an astonishing, distorting and disorientating thing.
More questions, please. Oh, a question there.
Yeah, hi. One of the maps that doesn't seem to have been discussed is the nautical chart. And it's interesting that seafarers, you know, sort of define the shape of continents. But what about the space in between? You know, sort of how early... Did they suddenly start getting some detail into that space in between the continents?
Mm. Well, some of the earlier plates in the atlas are nautical charts. Yeah. They are. I mean, this is not a map for navigation, but it is still a way of showing that it's part of this age of discovery in science. Is to have those charts in the early pages, even of this kind of, in some ways, non-practical map.
Yeah, because it mimics it. Can you see, if you see the map that David was talking about, all the toponyms, the names of places, they're all at right angles to the coast. So that's mimicking the way in which those early sea charts that you're talking about, which we call portolans. But it goes right back to the Greeks. They call them periploi. So they're written accounts of how you move from one island to the other. And you're right. It's the kind of basis of all forms of navigation. My father-in-law's somewhere in here. He's a sailor. And when you go sailing, you know, you can talk about Mercator and accuracy. But when you need to get from one point to the other, else you might die and drown, you have to use those maps. So there is, wherever, so your question was, is very, very important. Around using that kind of map, but it is a mimicry of that. It's saying, look, we have that technology of sailing charts, but you'd never use it because, you know, the scale is, of course, completely impossible.
Go directly to the question, though, about when. I mean, you and I were talking about the... sorry, we're professional Yorkshiremen, but the bloke who invented... What was it called?
Hey? What? Hey, what?
You what?
You what?
The bloke who invented...
Oh, John Harrison.
Can you get a whippet on, sir?
Yeah, he will.
John Harrison.
John Harrison, chronometer. Yeah, you know the story of longitude, yeah, because he invented the way in which you work out longitude.
But this was about that time, wasn't it? Yeah. Basically, later. You had to hug the sea lanes down from Spain and Portugal and then nip round the bottom and hug this. You didn't know what was out there. There'd be dragons.
Kept land in sight.
Yeah, and then, yes, he kept land in sight so he could know where you are. But this guy invented this thing. He could now go off 300 or 400 miles out and still know roughly where you were. Mm. So it's approximately from then that I think those blanks start getting filled in, which is what date?
Yeah, it's late 18th century. Harrison is late 18th century. It's the great book, D'Avisabelle's book, Longitude, is really the story about how you work out longitude. So going up and down is easy because you can use the sun, but going east to west, you need a timepiece that can give you accurate times. So you move across east-west.
And the timepiece at sea can't use a pendulum.
Absolutely,
that's the problem.
We've been there. We have just time of maybe one, maybe two more questions. Another question. Any more questions?
The gentleman there.
Oh,
I was really struck by Emma's point about the clans and that sort of sense of place. Have the panel come across any studies into whether there is any sort of, I don't know, genetic, geographical memory sort of that isn't explained by your life experience up to that point?
I'm not aware of it.
I don't know. Yeah.
I think it kicks in when you know more of your stories, although the spooky bit about Emma's story is that she didn't know the story and it kicked in.
Mm-hmm. And there was an urge in me to romanticise that, you know. I think, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I guess you do feel a pull to certain places that you can't explain, and who knows what that's to do with. I think there's probably lots of things that we can't explain about that magnetic connection sometimes to places.
I did my DNA test. I'm 3% Italian, but even before I discovered that, my favourite food was Italian.
Spooky!
Okay, that's where we're going to go next. Okay, I'm going to, with that lovely point, we're going to sort of pull it to an end, and I just want to thank our guests, David, Emma, and Tim. Thank you so much. Thank you. And can I just say, you can find all the episodes of What's Your Map and the maps discussed, and they're on a website, oculimundi.com, oculi-mundi.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast on all major platforms should you wish to do so. And I'm going to say goodnight to you and leave you with one question. What's your map? You can think about that when you go home. Thanks so much for coming. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.